Okay, let's dive in. I heard this story recently that really stuck with me
Oh, what is it?
about this elderly couple at McDonald's. They're sharing just one meal, you know?
Okay.
And someone offers to buy them another, but the old guy says, "No, we share everything."
Sharing everything.
So they split the burger, the fries, one drink, two straws, the whole deal. But then they just sit there,
Not eating.
not eating. The guy who offered is confused, asks what's up, and the old man just leans over and says,
What? We're waiting for the teeth.
"Oh, wow. Okay. They really did share everything."
Right. It really makes you think about shared experiences, doesn't it? And that brings us to today's topic.
A very different kind of shared experience, I gather.
Exactly. We're looking at the shared experience of survival, specifically the harrowing captivity of an American POW in Vietnam.
Right. That McDonald's story is about intimacy built over a lifetime, but for POWs. That sharing, that bond, it's forged in, well, extreme adversity. Mutual survival. Totally different, but maybe just as profound. So today, our whole focus is this firsthand account, an airman who spent, get this, 2,703 days as a POW.
Over 7 years. It's almost unbelievable. And this is from the YouTube video, episode 71 on Military Tales.
That's the one. Surviving Captivity, 2,703 Days, a POW's harrowing Vietnam story. Our mission here is to really unpack his experience from that episode.
Extract those key moments, the insights.
Yeah, the resilience, the camaraderie, the sheer reality of it all, it's more than just history, you know? It's about the human spirit pushed to its absolute limit.
And episode 71 really captures that. The sheer weight of that time, 2,703 days. It's hard to even comprehend.
It really is. So in the video, he starts by taking us back to his childhood.
Whereabouts?
Small cotton town, eastern North Carolina. Right near the Virginia border, off I-95, he even mentions a local billboard, Runnemp Rapids. Little details like that really ground it.
And you can imagine that kind of community, that small town feel, probably shaped him quite a bit, especially thinking about service.
He talks about that directly. In episode 71, he describes visiting this plexiglass wall in the local cotton mill with his grandfather.
What was on it?
Names of everyone from town who served, each with a little American flag. World War II, guys, his grandfather explained. A real lesson in sacrifice.
Wow. A very visible, tangible thing.
And then it hit him harder because he started seeing names he knew. His dad, his uncle, cousins.
Really personal connection.
Yeah, even an old friend who walked with a limp. Turned out he had a purple heart.
It makes history feel very immediate, doesn't it? Not
Yeah,
just abstract name.
exactly. And then the really somber part, some names had stars next to
The
them.
ultimate
That's
sacrifice.
what his grandfather called it. And he links this directly to his own generation's wars. Korea, the Forgotten War, and then Vietnam.
Is war.
Right. He mentions the sheer scale of loss, over 58,000 names on the wall eventually. And he contrasts the idea of a high school senior trip with where so many of his peers actually ended up.
Senior trip to Vietnam, that's stark. It highlights the massive disruption and sacrifice for that generation.
So then in the video, he shifts to joining the Air Force, and he's got this like really dry wit about it.
Oh, yeah.
Compares military recruiters to weathermen, politicians, used car salesmen. Says they all went to the same school of persuasion.
I think many veterans might agree with that sentiment, that feeling of being a small part of a huge machine.
Totally. He talks about basic at Lackland, tech school at Shepherd. Then the dream sheet.
The infamous dream sheet. Where did he want to go?
Alaska, apparently. Where did he end up? Altus, Oklahoma?
Oklahoma, not quite Alaska. SAC base, right? B-52s, missiles.
Yeah, Strategic Air Command. And he was a helicopter crew chief, felt like he was at the bottom of the pile there.
Happens a lot. Big organizations, unpredictable assignments.
A year later, he gets orders for Korea. And he describes this briefing from an old staff sergeant that really stuck with him.
What was the gist?
Basically, when you're overseas, you represent everyone, yourself, your family, the Air Force, the whole USA.
That's a heavy responsibility.
Yeah, and he makes this pointed comment, wishing Jane Fonda had gotten that same briefing, you know, reflecting the feelings of the time.
A very divisive period. Understandable sentiment from his perspective.
Then comes another green sheet. He jokes he'd put down anywhere USA.
Did that work out?
Got him called into the chief's office real quick. He wanted Seymour Johnson anywhere in the Southeast Florida.
And where did the Air Force wisdom send him?
Grand Forks, North Dakota.
North Dakota, the opposite of Florida.
Right. He quotes Will Rogers. Something about lies, damn lies, and statistics. A funny way to put a frustrating reality.
It really captures that clash between expectations and the often, well, arbitrary nature of military bureaucracy.
So eventually that detachment in Grand Forks closes down. He's actually thinking about getting out of the Air Force entirely.
But fate intervenes.
Fate intervenes. He gets orders for Indochina, Southeast Asia. He remembers thinking back on those last few years, heading into, well, total uncertainty.
Yeah, that uncertainty was a huge factor for guys deploying early on, not really knowing the mission, the risks, a lot of anxiety.
And he paints this picture in episode 71, leaving Grand Forks in April 65. It's 24 degrees on the flight line.
Sure.
3 days later, Bangkok. 108 degrees, and he's still in his winter blues uniform.
Oh, man. Talk about culture shock and temperature shock all at once.
From there, it's off to Thailand, what he calls non-component Thailand, gets briefed on the rescue group.
So, supporting operations in Vietnam, but based outside the main combat zone?
Seems like it. And here's a key thing he points out. After the Korean War, the military basically got rid of dedicated rescue units.
Really? Why?
Thought they wouldn't need them again, apparently. Big mistake. Because now, with air ops ramping up in Vietnam...
Suddenly they desperately needed rescue capabilities. That lack of foresight is something.
So they had to scramble, repurpose these LBR planes, local base rescue, basically fire support aircraft.
Not designed for combat rescue at all.
Not at all. He gives an example of just a fire bottle hanging underneath. They had to modify them on the fly. Adding steel plates under the seats, sitting on old World War II flak vests, whatever they could do.
Just pure improvisation. Resourcefulness born out of necessity.
And get this part from episode 71, improvising in-flight refueling for helicopters.
How on earth?
55-gallon barrels of fuel, garden hoses, quick disconnects. Seriously.
Wow. That's incredibly risky. Ingenious? But risky.
He even jokes he got unofficial credit for two bombing runs when a barrel got jettisoned over North Vietnam by accident.
Ah, that's some dark humor there. It really underscores the urgency and the risks they were taking with these makeshift solutions.
Then the famous Jolly Green Giant helicopter finally arrives, supposed to be their replacement.
Ah, proper equipment at last.
Well, it was brand new, which meant...
teething problems, mechanical issues.
Yeah. Bingo. Plagued with issues. So, the Air Force solution... just extend their temporary duty indefinitely.
Of course. Keep the guys with the garden hoses flying.
And that leads up to September 20th, 1965, the fateful mission.
The day he was shot down.
Yeah, over North Vietnam. And he highlights the rules of engagement back then. Incredibly complicated.
How so?
They had to wait on the ground for 2.5 hours after the pilot was down, just to verify his identity.
2.5 hours? Why?
Fear the radio might have fallen to enemy hands. Bureaucracy in a life or death situation.
That delay in a rescue mission, that's potentially fatal. Seems like a major flaw.
Finally, they get the green light, head into the rescue area, light overcast, homing in on the beeper signal.
Okay, standard procedure once they got going.
Then, as he puts it, all hell breaks loose. The A1E Sky Raider escorts take hits.
Oh, no.
Last thing he hears from them over the radio is an order to unauthorized dispose of the ordnance in the local area.
Meaning, drop their bombs and leave. Abandon the rescue.
That's how he took it. He couldn't believe it, attributes it to guidance coming straight from the White House. And while the escorts were gone...
their helicopter was vulnerable.
Exactly. They get hit. Shot down.
A direct result of the escort leaving, essentially. Just terrible.
But he mentions one bit of luck, if you can call it that. They were on the side of a hill.
How did that help?
Meant the gunfire was coming down at them, not up from underneath. He thinks that saved their lives. The engines, rotor blades, transmission took the hits.
Still, a crash is a crash.
Right. As they're going down, he's the hoist operator holding the red cable. They crash land into bamboo.
Which he notes is no match for helicopter blades.
No. And the pilot they were trying to rescue, he's there, warns them the area is infested with enemy troops.
So, out of the frying pan.
And into the fire, with terrible equipment. One radio for four guys, one flare gun.
Woefully unprepared for evasion.
They find a hiding spot, hoping rescue is still coming, but the Vietnamese spot them pretty quickly.
Outnumbered, outgunned.
Yeah. The pilot makes the call. Live to fight another day. Surrender.
A horrific choice to have to make. From rescuer to captive... in minutes.
They're captured, marched off, and initially he says the villagers treated them almost like curiosities, like prize trophies.
Why? Just because they were different? Bigger?
Yeah, the size difference was significant.
Mm.
But that changes fast.
Yeah.
A blowhorn arrives. Propaganda starts. Suddenly, the locals turn hostile.
Wow, the power of directed messaging in action.
The guards who captured them actually try to shield them, get hit themselves. Then they get put on public display. Multiple times.
Humiliation tactic.
Just awful. And then comes transport or interrogation.
He describes this one terrifying moment first in a makeshift cell, tied up, blindfolded.
Okay.
Guards take him outside.
Huh.
He leans back, manages to see a freshly dug grave.
Oh, my God.
He was convinced that was it. His life was over. Just wondering if his body would ever get home.
I can't even imagine that feeling. Pure terror. But then, nothing. Something changes. The guards lower their weapons, pick him up, take him back to the cell.
Just like that. No explanation.
No explanation. He calls it a miracle, a sign he was meant to survive.
What a profound, terrifying, and ultimately, I guess, hope-giving moment. That had to shape his whole outlook.
Definitely.
Hmm.
After that, he's transferred to regular military custody, transported north towards Hanoi.
Was the journey dangerous?
Extremely. More public displays, close calls with their own side, American fighter jets strafing their truck.
Strafing their own guys' transport.
The drivers would just stop the truck, jump out, leave them there as targets. Truck got hit several times.
Unbelievable. Constant danger.
He even says almost casually they got into a car accident during the transport.
Just adding insult to injury. It's chaos.
Then crossing a river, blindfolded, tied up, lying in the bottom of a boat. He makes this dark joke about falling in a pool and yelling, "Don't flush it."
Using humor to cope with absolute terror. A common mechanism, but still.
Wow. Finally, they arrive. The Hanoi Hilton. Hoalo prison. He sees the high walls, break in glass, barbed wire. A guard points and says, "Home." His thought. Home is San Francisco.
A cruel irony.
And right away, entering the gate, he's separated from his pilot and the other airmen they'd crashed with.
Isolated immediately.
Didn't see his pilot again for 7 years. 7 years.
Devastating. What happened to the others?
He shares the story of their co-pilot, captured separately in Laos, actually escaped with Dieter Dengler and others.
Like the movie Rescue Dawn.
Exactly. But tragically, the co-pilot was killed by a villager during the escape attempt. His remains are still trying to be brought home.
Just heartbreaking. He reflects on how easily fates could have been swapped.
Yeah. A different decision, a different path. So inside the Hanoi Hilton, he lands in Nugai Village.
What was the cell like?
Tiny. Maybe 6 by 7 feet. A concrete slab for a bed, maybe 16 inches wide, 4.5 feet long. And a bucket. The bow bucket.
That's it. His whole world.
His whole world. For years. But then communication, hope, the tap code.
Ah, yes, the vital tap code learned from Colonel Risner.
Colonel Robinson Risner, the senior ranking officer, he taught them the system. 5 by 5 grid, tap out the letters, alphabet minus K, use C instead.
Simple, but incredibly effective. And the Vietnamese couldn't crack it.
Never figured it out. It was their lifeline. More than just info, it was connection. Yeah. Defiance, resisting that isolation.
Absolutely crucial for morale, for survival. Risner's leadership there was key.
And initially, he says, everyone thought the war would be short. So the main goal was just knowing who was there, getting a full accounting.
Keeping track of their brothers.
Yeah. He lists his possessions, couple pairs of clothes, drawstring, bit of soap, toothpaste, toothbrush, towel, mosquito net, blanket, metal cup.
The sum total of his belongings.
And he realizes that's it. For 8 Thanksgivings, Christmases, New Year's, just sinks in.
The sheer length of time again. And the diet, he mentions that too,
right? Oh, yeah. Oriental style, he calls it. Rice for breakfast, water for lunch. Supper was swell up.
Swell up? What's that?
Basically boiled weeds or grass, whatever seasonal vegetables they could find. Mostly grass.
Eating grass.
They figured out they ate about 117 different kinds, even gave them American nicknames.
Wow. Again, finding ways to cope, even naming the weeds, that's resilience. But the physical hardship, intense.
Meat. Almost never. Maybe a piece the size of your pinky finger. He mentions once a 2-pound chicken had to feed 87 men.
87 from one chicken. Unbelievable deprivation.
But there were 2 slightly better meals a year, Christmas and New Year's.
Even in a communist prison camp.
Apparently, Christmas wasn't totally ignored. They even got Bibles for one day. The meal might have slightly more meat, something sweet, coffee, maybe half a beer.
Small comforts, but probably meant the world psychologically. Yeah. Reminders of home, of tradition.
And then there's New Shoe Town. That was vital.
What's that?
Rumors. Whispers passed along the tap code network. Usually about the war ending soon, going home.
Keeping hope alive, even if the rumors weren't always accurate.
Exactly. He had his own mantra. Yesterday I was shot down. Today's today, and tomorrow I'm going home. said it every day.
A mental survival technique, right. One day at a time.
But then came a huge blow to morale, early 66. Robert McNamara's statement.
What did he say?
Declared that American POWs were expendable.
Expendable? Oh my God, how did that land?
Devastatingly. For the families back home, agonizing. For the POWs, it must have felt like complete abandonment, being forgotten.
Horrible. Whatever the political intention, the human cost of a statement like that is immense, just crushing hope.
Shortly after that, he gets moved to the Briar Patch.
Another section of the prison. Worse.
Much worse. Known for solitary confinement, like the Sante, he compares it to. Tiny cell, 5x8 maybe, no running water, no electricity.
And you mentioned being hogtied.
During the day, for safety, they claimed. Just brutal. Dehumanizing.
Unimaginable cruelty.
Then came the Hanoi March, parading the POWs through the streets.
A propaganda stunt. Did it work?
Backfired, mostly. Drew international condemnation. Showed the world how they were being treated. But the Vietnamese tried to spin it, offered forgiveness if the POWs apologized.
Apologized for what? Being shot down? Mm-hmm. Insulting?
And they forced choices on them. Support President Johnson or support the peace-loving Americans. Refusal meant beatings.
Coercion and torture.
Yeah, even if he made a choice. If it was the wrong one, more torture. Forced apologies. He talks about the POW code of conduct here.
How to resist. How to survive that.
The idea was don't sustain permanent injury. Knowing you have to give something, but don't give up the ship. Manage the information. Resist as long as you can.
A crucial framework for survival. Giving them guidelines, a sense of shared strategy.
And they got creative. Using fake names and confessions. Clark Kent, Gene Offey, Roy Rogers.
To signal they were being coerced. Yep. To discredit the confessions.
Exactly. But then tragedy struck. An American journalist somehow figured out Clark Kent was fake and reported it.
And the North Vietnamese found out.
Yeah. The POW using that name, Neil Tanner, ended up spending 22 months in leg irons because of it.
Oh, that's awful. Betrayed by one of your own countrymen, however unintentionally.
Yeah.
Consequences. So,
because his health was failing after all this, he eventually got moved again to the zoo, another part of the prison complex.
They're shuffling between different hells.
But through it all, they had this motto. Never give up, never give in, roll with the punches, bounce back, get ready for the next round.
Incredible resilience. And supporting each other was key.
Absolutely paramount. He stresses, don't question how someone else is surviving. Just offer encouragement. We're all doing what we have to.
That mutual support must have been everything.
But he says the absolute hardest part, watching your friends get tortured and being completely powerless to stop it.
The psychological torture of that, unbearable.
He also mentions the POWs in South Vietnam, whose fates were often even more uncertain, and he heaps praise on the families back home. Calls them the true heroes.
Keeping hope alive, advocating, dealing with that terrible uncertainty for years.
His own sisters kept his memory alive for his nieces and nephews who were born while he was gone. His parents kept the light burning for him the whole time, over 8 years.
Incredible dedication and love from the families. They suffered immensely, too.
Eventually, conditions started to improve slightly when they were moved into larger groups.
Why the change?
Partly, the Vietnamese were just running out of solitary cells. They hadn't planned for such a long war, so many prisoners.
An ironic consequence of their own underestimation.
And he reiterates, they never followed the Geneva Convention, labeled the POWs as criminals, denied access to the International Red Cross.
Isolating them completely from outside help or oversight.
Yeah, even the American Red Cross had to stop sending packages for a while because they found them on dead North Vietnamese soldiers.
Just awful. Everything was weaponized against them.
President Johnson's announcement in 68 about stepping down and seeking peace. The POWs mostly saw it as political maneuvering. He notes no POWs or families were ever invited to the White House during LBJ's time.
Feeling completely unheard, unacknowledged by their own government at the highest level. More fuel for that sense of abandonment.
And when the bombing stopped under Johnson, that killed the home in 3 months, rumors.
A double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Less danger from bombs, maybe, but also less hope for a quick end.
Exactly. Felt like 3 years of being totally forgotten, no outside information. Then, slowly, things started to change again. Food got a bit better. Packages and letters started arriving, but very sporadically.
Still inconsistent. Unfair distribution.
Totally uneven. And he says his real anger, his lasting resentment, it's not for how he was treated. It's for how the families were treated back home.
That speaks volumes about his character. focusing on their suffering.
He mentions some families only found out their loved one was being released about a week beforehand, after years of waiting.
The emotional whiplash must have been intense.
He himself was MIA missing in action for 3.5 years before they even confirmed he was a POW. Imagine that for his parents.
3.5 years of not knowing if he was alive or dead. Agonizing.
But then, a moment of incredible connection to the outside world. 1969. A sugar packet.
A sugar packet? How?
From a care package.
Yeah.
It had American history facts printed on the back, and one mentioned Neil Armstrong walking on the moon.
Wow. Learning about the moon landing from a sugar packet in the Hanoi Hilton.
Isn't that amazing? He said the POWs all went outside that night and saluted the moon. The guards were totally baffled.
A shared moment of pride and wonder, even in captivity? That's powerful.
They'd share photos from packages, make up stories about them just to keep the images, the connection alive. Seeing photos of other guys' families together was deeply emotional.
Reminders of everything they were missing, everything they were fighting to get back to.
And he tells this incredible story about a fellow POW named Mike.
What did Mike do?
He made an American flag from scraps of cloth, anything he could find. Tiny. Hit him.
Wow. Incredibly risky.
Senator McCain, also a POW there, apparently saw them reciting the Pledge of Allegiance to this handmade flag.
A powerful act of defiance and patriotism.
Mike hit it, but the guards eventually found it. He was beaten severely, brutally.
For making a flag.
But Mike's response, as soon as he recovered, he started making another one.
Unbelievable courage, the determination, the symbolism of that flag meant everything.
It really sums up their spirit. He describes POW life so perfectly in one phrase from the episode.
What is it?
Minutes, hours, days, weeks, months. Yes, even years of boredom punctuated by sheer terror.
That captures it. The long stretches of nothing, then sudden, intense fear.
He credits President Nixon with understanding the situation better than LBJ, seeing that the North Vietnamese weren't really fighting their own war, getting support from elsewhere.
And Nixon focused on building up the South Vietnamese army. Vietnamization.
Right. By December 72, he says, the U.S. military mission was basically done. The only real sticking point left. The POWs.
The last piece of the puzzle.
The Vietnamese were apparently dismissive, like, just go home without them. But Nixon wouldn't leave them behind, referenced French POWs still held from the 50s.
Taking a firm stance, no man left behind. That must have given them hope.
And then came Linebacker II, December 1972.
The Christmas bombings. Very controversial. Very intense.
Intense bombing campaign aimed squarely at forcing Hanoi back to the table to release the POWs. Over 500 American prisoners by then.
And did it work?
He says it did. It brought the Vietnamese back to negotiate seriously. And on January 26th, 1973, the announcement...
The war is over.
War over. POW release to begin February 12th. Full withdrawal by March 29th. The news they dreamt of for years.
I can't even imagine the feeling. Relief, disbelief, joy, after everything.
He actually came home in one of the earlier groups, but he remembers being immediately hounded by the press.
Focusing on negative stuff.
Yeah, focusing on the controversies of the war, not the homecoming. He just wanted to wait for his brother, still back there, told the press to come back March 29th when everyone was home.
His focus was still on his fellow POWs. Solidarity to the very end.
He remembers celebrating Valentine's Day on the journey home. Philippines, Guam, Hawaii, San Francisco, and he shares that definition of freedom from another POW.
But what you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Freedom is doors with inside knobs, losing that basic control for 2,703 days.
Puts everything in perspective. Such a simple thing, but it means autonomy, agency, everything they lost.
When they got back, he says, many people treated them like royalty. True heroes welcome in many places.
As they deserve.
But he was also really disheartened to hear stories of other Vietnam vets being told to take off their uniforms when they landed back in the States, ashamed of their service.
Yeah, the reception was tragically mixed for Vietnam veterans, a really difficult homecoming for many.
He expresses just deep, enduring gratitude for everyone who worked to get them home, but he shares his saddest moment.
What was that?
Trying to forgive those who fled the country or protested, while feeling the nation hadn't fully honored those who did serve and sacrifice. Including Canadians who fought alongside them.
That's a complex feeling, trying to reconcile different responses to the war.
And he just lays out the cost. Yeah. 300,000 permanently injured, more limbs lost than all other U.S. wars combined, over 58,000 dead, 1,500 plus still MIA, 20,000 kids left fatherless. The terrible odds for downed air crews.
Staggering numbers. a reminder of the immense human cost.
He talks about the difficulty people had separating the war from the warrior, the negative media portrayals sometimes.
A problem that persisted for a long time, and sadly repeated in later conflicts too.
But he points out that Vietnam veterans themselves stood up. They made sure later generations returning from Iraq, Afghanistan wouldn't face that same disrespect.
Absolutely. They fought that battle on the home front too, insisting on separating feelings about policy from respect for the service member, a crucial distinction.
So wrapping up this deep dive into episode 71, I mean, the overwhelming thing is just that resilience, isn't it? The spirit of these guys.
Unbreakable, truly. The aha moment is understanding that sacrifice wasn't just the capture. It was the duration, the day-in, day-out endurance, the commitment to each other.
Yeah. And what really stays with you is that perspective they gained. You mentioned the closing words from the speaker in the video.
Yeah, from another former POW, about the privilege of being an American, because he'd seen the alternative, lived it, saying the American system, yeah, it has flaws, but it still beats all the others. That comes from a place of deep, hard-earned conviction.
It really does. And he emphasizes the burden we place on young people generation after generation to defend that freedom.
It's a heavy burden.
Yeah.
Which leads to that bumper sticker quote he shares at the end.
Right. Only two defining forces have ever offered to die for you. Jesus Christ and the American soldier. One for your soul, the other for your freedom.
Pretty powerful words to end on. Makes you stop and think.
Absolutely. So the final thought for you listening. Just take a moment, reflect on what freedom means to you personally, and remember the sacrifices, like the ones we heard about today from episode 71, that were made to protect it. It's vital we explore these stories, understand these experiences, and honor those who served.